Chapter 3. Mysticism in World Culture. Several themes dominated my life from a very early age. One was that I hated the idea of wasting time. My idea of hell was standing in line, or being trapped at an airport, or any other unproductive use of time. But after learning to meditate, I realized I would never waste time again, because even if I was just waiting in a line, I could use that time to work on deepening my samadhi. I could literally make use of every waking moment, because during the dead moments when I wasn't engaged in something specific, I could use the time to cultivate my concentration. Because I was part of the 1960s, another theme in my life was that I liked getting high. Samadhi became for me an amazing kind of high. It's legal, doesn't cost anything, deepens over time, it's good for the mind and body, and replaces the need for a drug-induced high. And it was available anytime I wanted it. Learning to bring the samadhi experience into my daily activities totally revolutionized how I thought about my day. The day was now a sequence of opportunities to go deeper. More complex activities were challenges. How deep can I stay when I'm cooking, shopping, talking with someone? I wanted to spend more time deepening my concentration. I marveled at how the Buddhist tradition had created a methodology which anyone could use to systematically improve their concentration and live their lives consciously, enjoying a highly focused state. Because I had experienced this totally within the context of Buddhism in Asia, through Asian languages, I originally thought that such states were to be found only in Buddhism. What happened next was interesting. I went to a session, or Zen retreat. In Japan, such retreats are notoriously tough. I call them samurai boot camps. As we were all sitting down to begin the week of intensive training, I noticed that there was another foreigner present. Not just any foreigner, but a Roman Catholic priest. I thought it was pretty unusual and interesting that a Catholic priest would come to a Zen retreat. I also thought that this poor guy must have no idea what he was getting himself into. He shocked me right away, however, by sitting down in perfect lotus posture and entering samadhi. You can tell the depth of someone's meditation by the way they sit, and he was sitting like a veteran Zen monk. During a break, I introduced myself and discovered that he was an Irish Jesuit. That's how I met Father Bill, mentioned previously in Chapter 1. Father Bill spent his life as a missionary in Japan, but he was a very unusual missionary, a sort of bi-directional missionary. He had originally come to Japan to propagate Christianity, but he felt that he would never be able to do that unless he understood the soul of the Japanese people, and he felt that he could only gain that understanding by having the Zen meditation experience. He had already had at least a decade of Zen training by the time I met him, and had also written several books, including the now classic Christian Zen. Through those books, he rekindled an interest in systematic focus techniques throughout the Christian world. Father Bill and I became friends, and I learned that he no longer saw his Zen practice as a mere aid to cultural understanding. It had become a way for him to reconnect with something that had been almost lost within the Christian tradition. He explained to me that a rich tradition of concentrative meditation had existed for centuries in the Christian West. The same state of high concentration that we were experiencing through Zen practice had been a central feature of Christianity until just a few centuries ago. This was mind-boggling for me, because I had no idea that any system for cultivating that state existed anywhere outside of Buddhism, let alone in the West. Father Bill's personal library at his residence in Tokyo opened my eyes even further. There were books on meditation and mysticism from many different cultures. It dawned on me that techniques for attaining states of high concentration were central to all the religious traditions of the world. All the world's religions have a meditative core, which is sometimes referred to as the mystical or contemplative side of that religion. Suddenly, I realized my own personal experience in Buddhism was part of a phenomenon that is universal for human beings. Three types of spiritual experience. Very broadly, there are three aspects to religious or spiritual experience around the world. The first is what I call the spirituality of thought. The vast majority of people have their religious experience centered around concepts, belief systems, prayer, dogmas, faiths, credos, and so on. This is the most common form of spiritual experience because adult human beings are very centered in their thinking process. Word-centered spirituality reaches its extreme in fundamentalism. This form of rigid relationship to concepts is found in every country and religion around the world. Sometimes fundamentalists within a religion end up persecuting the contemplatives within that religion. This is not just something in the distant past. It has happened in our time. Jihadis tend to persecute Sufis. Many aspects of human spirituality have a good side and a not-so-good side. The not-so-good side of fundamentalism is that it can bring out the worst in people. But it's also an easy and natural way to bring out the best in people. I wouldn't want you to think that I'm wholly condemning it here. In fact, it's a natural tendency for humans, and as such should be appreciated, although probably not encouraged. I've taken to heart the words of the Roman playwright Terence. Homo sum humani, a me nihilum alienum puto. I am human, so nothing human should be alien to me. The second type of religious experience I call the spirituality of feeling. It is characterized by devotion, piety, and what we might call the heart. We human beings are, after all, not just thinking creatures, we're also feeling creatures. People have always felt a sense of what the Romans call the noumen, the mystery, that which is awesome, awe-inspiring. We experience feelings of love, awe, and devotion with respect to the spiritual source. We feel love and devotion for Jesus or Krishna. A spirituality centered in feeling is called pietism in the West or bhakti in the East. Currently on planet Earth, most religion is either based in feeling, based in thinking, or a mixture of the two. But there is a third kind of spirituality, which is the one that I find most interesting. The technical term for it is mysticism. Unfortunately, in everyday colloquial English, the word usually implies something occult, weird, airheaded, new age, impractical, or obscure. However, this is not at all what scholars of religion understand by mysticism, a term they have borrowed from Christianity. In Christianity, spirituality centered on states of high concentration was referred to as mystical theology. Scholars then generalized the term to cover the worldwide phenomenon. We might also call this kind of spirituality cosmic consciousness, or the spirituality of enlightenment, although these terms can also lead to misunderstandings. What sets mysticism apart from the spirituality of thought or feeling is that it involves the cultivation of high concentration. In terms of organized religions at this point in history, this third type of spirituality is definitely in the minority. However, just because something is in the minority doesn't mean that it is not extremely important. Relatively few people master the equations of quantum physics, but that doesn't mean that quantum physics lacks relevance. I read everything in Father Bill's library that I could about spirituality as practiced by the meditators and the contemplatives of the world. It was quite astonishing for me to discover that all over the world, and in every historical period, there had been people who lived their lives in the state of high concentration that I was just beginning to explore. I began to feel a link to them all. It was fascinating to feel that I shared something deep and important with people living centuries ago and having customs and beliefs completely different from mine. I realized that when we practice meditation, we are engaging in a quintessentially human endeavor. The science of enlightenment doesn't belong to any particular religion or culture or period. Rather, it belongs to humanity as a whole and helps us to connect to our basic humanness. One way to trace the theme of meditation in world spirituality is through vocabulary. Most of the world's contemplative traditions have a generic technical term that designates any concentrated state. In addition, there are often specific technical terms used to describe different depths or levels of concentration. When we take the systems and put them side by side, we notice some broad parallels between the Christian, Jewish, Islamic, Taoist, Buddhist, and Hindu systems of contemplation. Meditation traditions in the Abrahamic religions. Let's start in the West. Most Westerners, whether Jews, Christians, or Muslims, don't have a clue that members of their religious tradition actively cultivated meditative states at some point in the past. If you were to ask even well-informed Jews, Christians, or Muslims the technical term within their religions for a state wherein the mind becomes highly focused, most wouldn't know what to tell you. But these terms do exist and reflect what was once a rich tradition of cultivated concentration. According to the Catholic Church, there are two kinds of prayer. The first type of prayer is what most people today usually think about when they hear the word prayer, creating words and images in the mind and feelings in the body about God. We talk to God, we think about God, we feel an emotional connection to God. This type of prayer is known technically as discursive prayer, meaning prayer in the nature of a discourse or a conversation. The second type of prayer is called non-discursive prayer, or the prayer of quiet. In this type of prayer, we go into a state of very deep peace and high concentration that is without words. Prayer of quiet, hesychia in Greek, is, roughly speaking, the Christian term for samadhi. Another term for high concentration in Christianity is recollection. This word does not mean to remember, as it does in modern English. Rather, it means to gather back together. In other words, to become concentrated. We gather the scattered mind. We recollect it. In fact, a Catholic priest is required to become recollected for at least one moment, even if he can't be recollected in his daily life. That moment is when he consecrates the host. In former times, great numbers of Christians wanted not just sporadic moments of recollection, but to be able to live their entire lives in the recollected state. That led to the development of monasteries. If you're familiar with European history, you probably know that at one time monasteries dominated the landscape of Europe. Only a fraction of those have survived. Most were destroyed by wars and revolutions. What were those monasteries used for? In essence, they were the meditation centers of the medieval world. The monastic system of Europe was founded by Saint Benedict. According to the Benedictine tradition, the main reason for entering the monastery is to attain a habitually concentrated state, recollectio, and to use that to radically transform oneself, conversio. A monastery is like a giant feedback mechanism where a person's life is simplified, and there is nothing to do but concentration-building activities like simple physical labor, chanting, prayer, and so on. Before the Counter-Reformation, in the 16th century, obtaining the prayer of quiet was deemed central to European Christian life. It's still central in the Eastern Orthodox form of Christianity. There are perhaps three works that best exemplify the Christian meditative tradition. The Interior Castle of St. Teresa of Avila, who was a Spanish Carmelite nun, is useful because she analyzes the prayer of quiet into a series of well-defined levels. It makes it easy to see the different benchmarks along that continuum, and how they rather roughly line up with the standard Buddhist system of 8 or 9 absorptions. Another book is called The Cloud of Unknowing by an anonymous 14th century English author, which gives a very beautiful poetic description of the meditative process. Finally, there are the writings of Meister Eckhart, a 13th century Dominican. Eckhart's writings went unnoticed for many centuries, but he is now appreciated as among the greatest Christian mystics. Within the Jewish tradition, the general Hebrew term for the state of high concentration is kavanah, which literally means maintaining one's direction. The 11th century rabbi Baya ibn Pakuda famously said, "Prayer without kavanah is like a body without a soul." In other words, if you attend all the services and say all the prayers, but you're not in a recollected state, then you've missed a basic point of Judaism. The Jewish meditative tradition is found within a body of literature known as the Kabbalah. Unfortunately, much of what you'll find in the Kabbalah is nothing more than superstition and manipulative magic, that is, mysticism in the sense of New Age fluff. On the other hand, if you dig deep and know what to look for, there are some real gems. Of particular importance is the notion of Bitul Hayesh, the annihilation of the somethingness within you. According to the Kabbalah, if we are willing to go through this annihilation of somethingness, we can have a direct experience of what in Hebrew is known as Briah Yesh Me'ayin, how the source creates things from nothing, continuously, moment by moment. As you'll see later in this book, This is a central theme in my formulation of enlightenment. In the Islamic tradition, the main way of cultivating the state of high concentration is by chanting and dancing, and the people who practice it are called Sufis. This way of developing high concentration is called zikr in Arabic, which literally means remembrance. Like all paths of deepening concentration, zikr eventually culminates in a state of concentration so great that we start merging with things, a state which is sometimes referred to as unitive experience. In the Muslim tradition, this unitive experience is called fana, annihilation. There are two kinds of fana. The first is called fana fil sheikh. Sheikh means teacher or elder in Arabic. As Sufi students dance and chant, the first kind of merging they experience is with their teacher. I'll describe the mechanism that allows for that a little later in this chapter. Sufis eventually go beyond that to experience the second kind of fana, which is called fana fila, dissolution into Allah, into the source, into a oneness with God. So technical terms for levels of high concentration and mystical experience are also present in Islam. Famous Sufis include Rumi, Al-Halaj, and Al-Ghazali. As you can see, there exists a rich vocabulary of technical terms in the Western traditions describing states of concentration and their impact on one's life. Now let's move to the East. Meditation traditions in the East. In classical Taoism, the state of high concentration is called Shoui, which means to hold to the one, or Zuowang, to vanish where you're sitting. The Taoist meditative tradition developed in several stages. First came the philosophy of oneness exemplified in the teachings of Lao Tzu and Chuang Tzu. In this system, the mystical one was called the Tao. We achieve the Tao through surrendering to the fundamental forces of the universe, expansion, yang, and contraction, yin. Later masters developed an elaborate technology of physical exercises involving three steps to facilitate this process. First, essence, jing, is transmuted into energy, qi. Then energy is transmuted into spirit, shan. But what the hell is essence? Well, it sometimes means sexual sensation, but more broadly, it can refer to any distilled sensory experience, that is, any sensory flavor you concentrate fully on. For example, pure emotional joy, or pure physical pain, or pure breath pleasure. Put another way, the essence of a given sensory category is achieved when there's only that flavor, and it pervades your entire being. We tend to be afraid of letting a single sensory quality distill into its essence, even if it's something pleasant like sexual sensation. We're afraid to let just one sensory essence pervade our entire being for a significant period of time, because we think that we will be utterly overwhelmed. But we need not fear, because very quickly, essence transmutes into energy, qi, and then energy transmutes into spirit, shan. Although the words sound quite different, the Taoist experience of qi and shan is related to the Buddhist experience of anicca, impermanence. Qi and shan represent two stages in the process of contacting the impermanent nature of a given sensory event. After you have held a single sensory quality in a concentrated state long enough, essence, jing, you start to notice subtle waves and vibrations in that event. Those waves and vibrations are qi. At a deeper level, that sensory event polarizes into pure yang and pure yin. Pure yang is a kind of efflux, space effortlessly spreading out. Pure yin is a kind of reflux, space effortlessly pulling in. Space itself is simultaneously expanding and contracting. That's shan. This roughly parallels something that happens in the material world. A frozen substance may melt into liquid, jing, then vaporizes into gas, qi, and finally polarizes into a plasma, shan. In other words, what the Buddhists call impermanence, the Taoists view as an energy flowing in patterns, a practice called neidan, which means internal alchemy. The term neidan has an interesting history. For hundreds of years, the Taoists pursued physical immortality through physical alchemy. They felt that certain substances, such as mercury, could be transformed into pills that would give immortality. This elixir of immortality turned out to be impossible, of course. When they realized that there was nothing in the outside world that would give them immortality, they got the idea that perhaps there might be an internal alchemy, an elixir of immortality that could be found within sensory experience. And indeed, it's true. Within each of us is a sort of eternal fountain of youth that constantly gushes and gathers. Now let's visit India. When it comes to systematic, principled approaches for developing concentration power, India is without peer. We can see this quite clearly in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, which has been a source text in the yogic tradition since the 4th century. Today we think of the word yoga as meaning a certain type of physical exercise. But yoga is a generic term, referring to many kinds of practices, including spiritual exercises. Patanjali's system of cultivating high concentration is called Raja, Royal Yoga. The Raja Yoga system contains an early and very clear description of states of concentration. Raja Yoga is also sometimes referred to as Ashtanga, eight-limbed yoga, because it describes a spiritual path in terms of eight steps. The final three steps, or inner limbs, are directly related to the theme of this chapter, because they describe different levels and flavors of the concentrated states. According to the Raja Yoga system, the first step in the concentration continuum is dharana, which literally means holding. In dharana, you take some object and attempt to concentrate your awareness on it. The object of focus could be anything: the breath, a sound, a visualization, a flower, a person. When your attention wanders, which inevitably it will, you gently bring it back to the object. When it wanders again, you gently bring it back again, over and over. This act of bringing the attention back each time it wanders is called dharana. We are making an effort to hold on to the focus object. As I mentioned previously, we can compare the process of developing concentration strength to the process of exercising a muscle. When we exercise a muscle, we use that muscle to lift a weight over and over, and as a result, the muscle gets stronger. The stage of dharana is comparable to this, except that instead of working against the force of gravity, we're working against the force of distraction. Each return to the focus object is equivalent to a rep in weightlifting. It's hard work, but it's one of the main ways that the concentration muscle is built. The second step in Raja Yoga's concentration continuum is called dhyana. This word could cause some confusion, because the term is used in Buddhism in a similar but not identical way. Within the context of Raja Yoga, dhyana is what comes after we have paid our dues, so to speak. We've brought our attention back over and over again to our object of focus, and finally, the attention doesn't wander but stays put, gently resting on that object. That's dhyana. In the state of dhyana, our attention is like pouring a steady stream of oil upon an object, without any breaks or gaps in the stream. It's a smooth, continuous stream of contact with the focus object. Once we are able to do this with a specific sound or breath sensation or other sensory category, we can generalize that ability to any other object. It's not like we have to learn the process entirely anew for each type of experience. Once we enter the dhyana phase, we find that when we're eating lunch, for example, our awareness flows unbroken onto the tastes and body sensations that constitute the enjoyment of the food. However, if while having lunch we start to engage in a conversation with someone, our awareness shifts immediately and flows totally onto just that person. When the person is talking, we're not caught up in our own thoughts and feelings. Instead, there's a constant flow of presence and attention toward the person. When the person is done talking, we go right back to being completely absorbed into the tastes of the food we are eating as we take the next bite. The awareness moves easily from object to object, yet no matter what it rests upon, there's an unbroken flow of attention. This is dhyana, according to Patanjali. The third and final step in Raja Yoga's concentration continuum is samadhi, which refers to unitive experience. Again, there is a possible confusion in terminology here, because in Buddhism, samadhi often refers to any level of concentration, from the lightest to the deepest. In the state of samadhi as understood in Raja Yoga, we not only have unbroken concentration, but we actually become the thing we are concentrating on. This is what is meant by the often heard phrase, to become one with something. It sounds sort of mystical, schmystical. But it's an experience reported the world over by all who enter states of high concentration. Let me explain in a simple way how this happens. If you carefully observe your day-to-day experience, you'll notice that whenever you see a flower or another person, or take a bite of food, or hear a sound, your awareness is usually divided. Part of your attention flows out into the objective experience, and part of it flows back into your subjective thoughts and feelings. In that moment, those thoughts and feelings create the sense of an internal I, who experiences the external it. But imagine what would happen if, for a period of time, all the attention flowed into the it, and none of the attention flowed back into your mental images, internal talk, and emotional body reactions. What would happen to the sense of I separate from it? The I would vanish, leaving only the it for a while. Initially, we can maintain such merging or oneness only for a few seconds, but in the case of veteran meditators, it can be maintained continuously for minutes, hours, even days. The Raja Yoga system actually distinguishes two kinds of merging: Sabija Samadhi, Samadhi with a seed, and Nirbija Samadhi, Samadhi without a seed. This terminology may sound a little strange to modern ears, but it refers to something very specific and well-defined. In Samadhi with a seed, all sense of self disappears, and only the object of concentration remains, shining in consciousness. This is what I described in the preceding paragraph. The object that remains is the seed, which is still present even though the observer has vanished for a while. Samadhi without a seed takes the concentration to an even more extreme level. In this state, awareness flows so completely onto the object of concentration that there is no time to fixate that object as something rigid, opaque, and extended in time and space. In other words, the object of concentration ceases to be an object, ceases to be a something. To draw a metaphor from modern physics, the object ceases to be a particle and becomes a wave. That waveform fills our consciousness, and we become that waveform, and we are that wave. As we merge with the wave, it links to all the other waves in the universe. Then the wave dies away into deeply fulfilling nothingness. Observer and observed both disappear. This is Samadhi without a seed, a direct abiding at the still point of the turning world. This level of merging is both incredibly rich and refreshingly empty. It contains the totality of the universe, and it contains nothing at all, no concrete object. Hence, it's referred to as Samadhi without a seed, or pure consciousness, or true witness. That's the growth of concentration as described in the Yoga Sutras. We progress from simple focus exercises, dharana, to states of continuous concentration, dhyana, and finally to oneness with the unborn source, nirbija, or seedless samadhi. If you can consciously taste moments of seedless samadhi in daily life, we'll say you attained the initial stage of enlightenment. Now let's look at Buddhism. Here we find descriptions of a process somewhat similar to what we find in the Yoga Sutras, although formulated from a very different philosophical position. Buddhists traditionally divide the levels of concentration into 8 stages, 4 dhyanas, absorptions with form, and 4 arupyas, formless absorptions. As you'll recall, Buddhists tend to use the word samadhi as a generic term referring to any state of concentration, from Patanjali's dharana to dhyana, up to and including the sabija and nirbija states. This difference in usage often leads to massive confusion and endless, pointless quibbling over whose path goes further. Fortunately, that need not concern us here. From now on throughout this work, I will use the term samadhi in its generic sense, as Buddhists do. Note that many Buddhists regard concentration as good, but not sufficient for deep insight. They contrast concentration, calming practice, with clarity, observing practice, seeing them as different things. We'll look much more closely at this distinction in Chapter 4. Shamanism. As I mentioned earlier, scholars of comparative religion use the expression mystical experience as a general term for what I've been describing thus far in this chapter. There are any number of books that attempt to compare mystical experience across traditions. One thing I find interesting is that some of the older classic studies on comparative mysticism fail to mention the experiences of native peoples, such as American Indians, Australian Aborigines, Africans, and Polynesians. This is a glaring oversight, considering that mystical experience was probably somewhat common within such preliterate cultures. Consider the situation of our remote ancestors, humans living before the development of cities, literature, and technology. Viewed from the perspective of the modern world, how would we characterize their life? It seems to me that for most of human history, life was simple, uncomfortable, and full of things that people could not understand. One natural response to physical discomfort is to find ways to get comfortable. This eventually leads to the development of complex tools, building skills, and the rise of cities, writing systems, and technology. Analogously, one response to the mystery of things is to figure out how stuff works. This eventually leads to the development of science. Thanks to centuries of research and invention, we can be comfortable in our houses even in the dead of winter, and we don't get perplexed by phenomena such as eclipses or thunder or a woman's menstrual cycle. However, there is another equally natural response to physical discomfort, and that is to simply open up to the discomfort rather than fight it. In the same way, instead of flailing to find answers, we can let go of the need to know and open to the mystery of things. This second response is the core of the religion of tribal peoples, usually referred to as shamanism. Shamanism is often described as an attempt to acquire power through contact with the spirit world. But what often goes unappreciated is that in most cultures, the standard way to contact the spirit world is through physical ordeals, some of which can be quite severe. Shamanic ceremonies, such as the sweat lodge or sun dance, build concentration power and force equanimity. By equanimity, I mean a kind of detached, gentle matter-of-factness within which pleasure and pain are allowed to expand and contract without self-interference. The combined effect over a lifetime can bring enlightenment as a byproduct. I imagine that the reason some of the earlier studies on comparative mysticism failed to mention native cultures is that in these cultures, there is no technical vocabulary or intellectual model for enlightenment. People just experienced it. And they probably experienced it somewhat frequently, because everything about their ordinary life would have tended to push them in that direction. Because life was simple, it was relatively easy to enter states of mental quiet and high concentration. Whereas modern people struggle for years with the complexities of their wandering thoughts, native peoples could, by and large, become quite one-pointed after drumming or singing for just a few hours. So the simplicity of daily life would tend to make it easy for people to enter samadhi. Indeed, we could say that the formal meditation techniques used by people in post-literate civilizations are just a systematic way of doing what our remote ancestors did relatively naturally every day. Thus, among our remote ancestors, one natural response to their situation would have been to live in states of high concentration, in equanimity with discomfort, and in acceptance of not knowing things. Another response would have been to figure out stuff and get comfortable, but that resulted in life getting so complex that samadhi seldom occurs spontaneously. Furthermore, as we become habituated to comfort, we lose the natural ability to cope with discomfort through equanimity. So our remote ancestors experienced two oppositely directed forces. Expansively, they were motivated to figure stuff out and get comfortable. The figuring out led to science, and the getting comfortable led to technology. Contractively, they would naturally enter states of surrendering to the mystery by letting go of the need to know and surrendering to discomfort by dropping into equanimity. High states of concentration combined with detachment from the mind and body would naturally lead to a state of oneness with nature itself, a kind of contracting back to the simplicity of Father Sky and Mother Earth. Since both of these directions are natural, it seems to me that the ideal situation for humans would come about when both directions harmonize in a science of enlightenment. We'll explore that theme in detail in Chapter 11. So although native peoples may not have technical terms for various nuances of concentration, as are found in the other traditions, the fact is that the experience was there. Indeed, the absence of special vocabulary may indicate that samadhi wasn't a special state for them, but part of everyday life. in secular contexts. One might think that samadhi only arises within a spiritual context, but that is not the case. People can also achieve secular samadhis, which don't occur with a spiritual paradigm, but are still potentially paths to enlightenment. There are individuals who, through performing arts, like playing the piano, or dancing, or martial arts, spontaneously enter states of very high concentration. Over months and years, that state of high concentration may deepen and go through all the standard stages described by the religious mystics of the world. It also broadens, and they find themselves going into these states even outside of their art. Maybe they first experienced it playing the piano, then noticed they would go into that state in other activities in daily life. Sports is another area where people sometimes fall into these states spontaneously. The locker room term for samadhi is to be in the zone. For example, Ted Williams, sometimes described as the greatest hitter who ever lived, reported that when he entered the zone, his concentration was so great that he could see the individual stitches on the ball as it came at him at close to 100 miles an hour. Among people who develop a high concentration through a particular secular activity, some go beyond the state of high concentration. They don't just get completely focused when they dance. They tangibly taste a formless state of no self, big self as they dance. The dance, the dancer, and the audience all vanish into a pure doing of space. The dance continuously manifests from seedless samadhi, the still point of the turning world. The poet T.S. Eliot describes this beautifully. Except for the point, the still point, there would be no dance, and there is only the dance. If a person enters samadhi without a seed while performing some art, they are, strictly speaking, no longer performing. The universe itself is manifesting through their art. If they're able to replicate that state in daily life, then their sport or art can be legitimately described as a path to enlightenment. The most sophisticated pre-modern theory of performance can be found in the No Theater of medieval Japan. There are several traditional forms of Japanese theater, but No is the most ancient form and goes back to the 14th century. No, not kabuki, is the true classical theater of Japan, and in many ways is remarkably parallel to classical Greek drama. For example, there is a chorus, and the actors wear masks. One of the main creators of No acting theory, Zayami Motokyo, talked about what he called the flower. According to him, the flower is the absolute epitome of art, and very few people ever reach it. The flower is what happens when rigorous training, intrinsic talent, and deep no-self come together. The art is no longer a creation, it's a manifestation. Spontaneous awakening. Enlightenment experiences can sometimes occur without any practice whatsoever, by accident, as it were. Sometimes people just fall into a unitive or no-self state without any intentional seeking. Typically, this state wears off after a few minutes, hours, or weeks. This is because most people do not have the base level of concentration required to maintain the experience. Also, they may lack a conceptual framework with which to understand what is happening to them. For example, I once heard of an older woman with little education who had a major enlightenment experience. As she put it, "One day I just got big." She had had this major experience, but without any training or conceptual framework. All she could understand about it was that she had become big. In her particular case, the experience was permanent. But typically, spontaneous, no-self, big-self experiences do fade after some time. An old friend of mine named Flora Courtois had an experience like this when she was in college. It did not fade for her, and she spent many years trying to find another human being who could understand what had happened to her. She went to her priest, who did not have a clue about what was going on, and she went to her school psychologist, who was similarly clueless. Years passed, and she thought she was the only person in the world who had ever changed in that way. Then she read some books on Zen, and she met some Zen masters and realized that she was not the only one. She discovered that there was a whole tradition of it all over the world, and a whole methodology for achieving it. You can read about her in a booklet she wrote called An Experience of Enlightenment. At home in anybody's church. Enlightened consciousness can be found inside the core of each spiritual tradition. But it can also arise in secular settings through concentrative activities, such as sports and the arts. And sometimes it arises without any particular cultivation. It just happens to certain people. My goal in this chapter has been simply to sensitize you to the rather extraordinary fact that individuals living in different times, in different places, having totally different views of the world, all describe a basically similar sequence of stages of enlightenment. And most of these people didn't know about each other. Isaac Luria, the Jewish Kabbalist living in 16th century Palestine, never heard of St. Teresa of Avila. And St. Teresa of Avila certainly never heard of the Buddha. And none of these people ever heard of Lao Tzu. Yet we can find a broad similarity in how they describe their experience. Surveying mystical experience across traditions and cultures, we are struck by two extraordinary facts. Fact one, despite enormous cultural and philosophical differences, mystics describe their experiences in rather similar ways. Fact two, these descriptions sound counterintuitive and paradoxical to the average person. I believe that those two facts imply that enlightenment is something distinct and universal for humans. The English writer Aldous Huxley referred to this universal phenomenon as the perennial philosophy. I like this phrase. Perennial means something that is constantly coming back, constantly popping up again, in different ages, within different traditions, and within different cultures. It was one of the great mind-blowing experiences of my life to realize the essential unity of mystical experience around the world. For me, it was like discovering a kind of spiritual periodic table of the elements. Before that, like many people, I was confused by the differing claims and doctrines of the great religions. But now, I can see a unifying principle. Once you begin to have mystical experiences, you can feel right at home in anybody's church. I owe a great deal of gratitude to Father Bill for providing the books that so vastly expanded my spiritual horizon at a pivotal juncture in my life. To sum up, whenever we practice meditation, we are linked to a global phenomenon that has been a core human experience all over this planet for a long time. Whenever we practice meditation, we are sitting on the tip of a vast pyramid that extends out in space and back in time and directly links us to a global lineage involving thousands, perhaps millions, of extraordinary human beings, all the way back to our prehistoric ancestors. Knowing this moves me deeply.